Hello everyone, my name is Vlad Glavanu. I am the head of psychology and counseling at Webster University Geneva, and it is my great pleasure to be here today with Jan Walsiner, who is Niels Bohr Professor of Cultural Psychology at Aalborg University in Denmark, and who is at the forefront of the area of cultural psychology, editor, founder and editor of the Sage Journal Culture and Psychology, and editor and co-editor of many books and handbooks in the area. Jan, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here in the middle of a beautiful campus of Webster University.
Yes, we hope it transpires to people who are just listening to us. So to start with, I think many people wonder what cultural psychology is exactly. Where is it positioned in the field of psychology generally?
Well, cultural psychology is a basic science part of psychology that starts from human side. Mm-hmm. Rather than animal side. So it starts from higher level of psychological processes, mm-hmm. desires, feelings, religious systems, social systems,
right.
cognitive processes, and so on. So it's a very basic science that deals with very human issues.
Right, right. And for people who are familiar, for instance, with cross-cultural ways of doing psychology, what would you say, because you wrote extensively from the very beginning of the discipline about the differences between cultural and cross-cultural, how would you summarize perhaps those?
Well, cross-cultural psychology compares people from different societies and finds differences.
Right.
Cultural psychology looks at these differences and starts to study what is behind the differences. So cultural psychology is a basic science. Cross-cultural psychology is in its extension that provides valuable information but does not solve any problems.
Right, right. And the notion of culture, obviously, is a bit like the big elephant in the room. And a lot of historically, there have been so many definitions of it formulated. Do you personally believe that we should have a definition of culture? And if so, what is your working definition of it?
Well, culture is a very general label, which coincides with our common sense understandings in many ways.
Right.
For cultural psychology, it's a label that unifies a number of specific perspectives, maybe eight or so.
Right.
It's very valuable in the sense of a general focus that allows us to, for example, separate from biological psychology as a contrast. It doesn't have special value by itself. It's just classifying value is right there. What culture can be seen is something that is always encoded into human beings, in the person.
Right.
I personally would emphasize a culture belonging to the person, allowing me and the other person to live one's human types of lives. Other perspectives, like cross-cultural perspectives, consider a person to be in the middle of culture. I consider the opposite. Culture is in the middle of a person, any person.
Right. And you also wrote about kind of personal culture versus a more shared and collective culture. So this ethos of, first of all, not creating a distinction or separation between person and culture, but looking at their interdependence in many ways. In terms of methods, what would be the preferred methodology, you would say, for a cultural psychologist?
Well, as long as cultural psychology deals with human phenomena, quite obviously, all human phenomena are guided by signs.
Right.
So the semiotic science of semiosis and human cultural psychology have very close grounds. So in this sense, the method is always looking at the developmental orientation to how meanings are constructed over time by living human beings, active human beings who are trying to reach some goals in their lives.
Right.
And so on. So the method is always developmental rather than ontological, if we put it this way.
So looking at people in their development, kind of in action, but in the use of signs. And you've been a big promoter of the semiotic cultural psychology. You mentioned before that there are about eight or so big approaches. What is specific for about the semiotic approach to it? What would you say?
The semiotic approach has a very specific focus, which is that of the use of signs in regulating all the psychological processes human beings are involved in. So our understanding of how I am deeply honored by something, how I'm deeply disgusted by something. These are all produced by signs in specific moments in our everyday lives.
Right.
So the semiotic construction of meanings is going on all the time. We are compulsive meaning makers using signs.
Right. And if you are to think of an example of you've conducted research and you know a lot of research from colleagues in the field, what would be some recent or good examples that you think our listeners could think about when it's the construction of science? What areas of research would you
say? Well, let us take some very simple things like eggs. Eggs are very simple, as you know very well.
Right.
You have spent your lifetime studying them. But not eggs as they come out of a hen, but eggs as they become painted by human beings for specific Easter time occasions and so on. Mm-hmm. Why would a normal human being start to decorate an egg? It's nothing to do with eggs, but has everything to do with the rituals that are involved with Easter. Right. And there are specific inscriptions, there are very specific ornaments that are drawn on these eggs, are results of exactly this sign-mediated life. And so the method is very concrete. You give people some possibilities to modify something. Mm-hmm. For example, modify their own apartment, modify their own clothing, modify almost anything their hair do. Mm. And this result of all that's a process of how you modify yourself is exactly the target for cultural psychological research. Mm. And of course, the method is that of microgenetic analysis, looking very carefully at how the innovations are introduced.
Right, step by step, moment by moment. You mentioned eggs, so obviously you triggered me to think about ornaments as well, which is one of the latest, most recent points of interest you have. And ornaments obviously are so intertwined with what culture is generally. What made you study ornaments to begin with?
Ornaments are very interesting because they seem to be at first only decorative. Mm-hmm. And my point was that they are not just decorative, they provide us framing for all of our visual field, and let me add to it ornaments in sound, for example, music, provide us with a framework for our activities when we constantly listen to music. So ornaments are very central of guiding our ways of meaning construction in some directions rather than others. So that made me very interested in them, and everything else came after that, looking at role of different forms in human psychological relating with environment and so on.
And when you look at ornaments, I know a little bit about the work and I'm looking forward to reading the whole book. I know that you're collecting kind of evidence or looking at it historically in art, in places of worship. Where did you find ornaments of interest?
Well, the interesting finding is actually that I find the ornaments of interest, first of all, in landscapes. So being here at Webster University with all the mountains on the horizon is a good place to illustrate this. That's the tops of the mountain ranges and their movement in the different weather, and was it more visible, less visible. This is exactly the first ornaments that human beings would see when they look around. Later on, they start to depict it and then start to be the visual ornaments near to them. But first, they are perceiving the enormous variety of mountaintops, landscapes of different kinds. These are all the ornaments for our living.
Yeah, so ornaments are, you look at them as very closely linked to perception and meaning making, and they go beyond, as you said, kind of Easter egg ornaments, which are kind of intentionally ornamental, but ornaments can be found in landscapes and all around us, basically.
The basis for ornaments is in the frames of landscapes, the frames of textures of our environment, which are total. That is, you cannot get rid of the environment. You always are exposed to it. If you're in the middle of a mountain range, wherever you look, you will find the mountains.
Right.
If you're in the middle of a totally flat landscape, you see the horizon in all directions.
Mm.
But these are also the borders of the frames within which you make your meanings.
Yeah.
I know of Swiss people coming to Denmark. They look around, where are the mountains, and there are none.
No.
And then you see Danish people coming to Switzerland, and they look around and say, what are these horrible things around us? Where is my flat, nice flat landscape around?
So it's really a habituation as well.
This is an example which is cross-societal, Danish versus Swiss. But behind that is a shared aspect of relating to specific textures of the environment. In one case, mountainous, in other case, flat.
Right.
But in both cases, they're doing exactly the same. They are relating to the outer borders of the environment as they can perceive it.
And I know you are now working on an exciting and intriguing project about sensuality.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to reveal or tell us a little bit about why you moved to that topic in particular?
It actually grew out of the work on ornaments, because in the ornaments you would see the very constant orientation of the ornament experiencer to the specific feelings that the ornament covers, not directs, but covers. So the result is that specific implicit feelings are there, constantly guiding us. So our life is constantly sensual. We're looking out of the window, see beautiful trees. How do you know they are beautiful? We invent the notion of beauty, putting them onto the trees. We are fascinated by different specific man-made objects like water fountains and so on. So this all sensual environments that is, we are creating for ourselves.
Right.
The focus on sensuality is in some sense a contrast to Freudian focus on sexuality. I'm claiming that sensuality is a general human feature of living, and sexuality is only a specific side story out of sensuality, not relevant outside of the certain age ranges and certain functions. But basically, sensuality dominates our lives from birth to death.
Interesting. So basically, obviously, and it's another point I wanted to bring up, the history of cultural psychology and how it draws on so many kind of streams of thought. You mentioned Freud now. What would be, in your view, the founding fathers, maybe mothers? Sadly, we live in a world where ideologically male innovation is usually a privilege. But who are the founders of this field for you?
Well, the founders go back to the 19th century. They are come out of Sherman Welker psychology tradition very much. They also linkable with almost all of the developmental traditions from 19th century coming out from them. The original, maybe the original root for most of the ideas is Goethe and Goethe's version of Naturphilosophy taken over by others.
Right.
But not always developed very far. So it's a solid philosophical and aesthetics tradition in European context, which has parallels in non-European context as well. So it's a very versatile, strong tradition that would antedate official psychology by about 100 or so years.
Yes. And you've been also editing several handbooks, actually. I have one here, the Cambridge Handbook of Sociocultural Psychology with Alberto Rosa edited. And you've seen these handbooks in different editions, and they're substantial. They bring a lot of chapters together. Have you seen the field evolve in the past? You know, you've been working in it for decades now. What would you say was what grew into prominence? What maybe faded away?
Well, in the beginning, which is 1990s, the theoretical focus was much more clear, different perspectives. In 20 years later, we see it's still in different places proliferating, but there is, of course, very strong empirical orientation that starts to filter in.
Yes.
So that means many of the problems are still unresolved. Methodological issues are not made very clear, so it's a very much developing area. It's not becoming a fetish for anybody. So that's
right. So there are no ultimate answers to be found, but there are very good questions that keep on coming back.
Yes, that makes it very open. That's cultural psychology in this sense is an open part of human psychology where many problems can be suggested, can be analyzed, can be tried to be solved, and sometimes solved, sometimes not.
Right.
It's an open scientific enterprise. It's not fixed in terms of how to do things right.
And that's the beautiful part of it, that it allows kind of creativity in a way to come in through theory and method in ways that in other fields, it's kind of closed.
Yes, exactly. The creativity is guaranteed because there is no fixation. There is an open relation between theory, method, phenomena, and general axioms.
And thinking about these unresolved questions, the big questions, this is getting a bit kind of, personal, but what would you say, Jan, is one of these big questions that you've been preoccupied with for a long time, or maybe a question you're recently trying to answer, but an example of these kind of big questions that remain open?
Well, maybe the biggest question is how we live in the uncertain till irreversible time.
Mm.
The irreversible time is no surprise, no news. Henri Bergson, 100 plus years ago, started to emphasize it in philosophy.
Yeah.
Ilya Prigozhin put it into practice in physical chemistry. Psychologists from time to time talk about it, but they do not really take it into account. It's a big problem because if you think carefully, irreversibility of time guarantees that no single instance can be repeated.
Yes.
That means each instance in our lives is a unique, but at the same time lawful, phenomenon that we need to understand. And none of the existing methods in psychology allow this understanding. I think linguistics is ahead of us in psychology.
Right. So the irreversibility of time and how we account for it and fully understand its implications in... you also work with a lot of colleagues internationally, I mean, in Europe and abroad. Where would you say are some kind of centers if people are thinking, okay, I would like to study more cultural psychology? Can you think internationally and what kind of emphasis do they have?
Well, it's a very international discipline. It really includes colleagues from Brazil, Chile, United States, China,
right.
Australia. It's a very, very international network. I think if you want to study it more carefully, you have to decide exactly what you want to study, what is a specific topic, and then find a particular mentor, find a particular location. I think there are some very interesting new developments. There is an effort to develop an international network on cultural psychology and education located in Shanghai in China. There is also an effort to develop different perspectives on linking cultural psychology and counseling, let us say, in Brazil, in Salvador, Bahia. So there are many different, it varied from one place to another, but what is possible. But basically it's a network which is open for people who want to learn something new.
Right, and it's I can testify by having the chance to have gone to some of these places that it is a wonderful network and it's kind of living and breathing and changing in its own way. And hopefully Webster Geneva is also trying to be part of it, perhaps with an emphasis more on creativity and innovation, but every center has its own lifelong perspective or counseling, as you mentioned, and so on. You mentioned bringing in students and inviting people in, and I think one of the most wonderful things you have done through the years was to encourage young people, undergraduate students, to participate. What would you advise these young students who meet psychology, who come into psychology generally, then meet maybe cultural psychology? What should they do or how should they approach it?
Well, they are the young people who still have the energy and who have the eagerness and curiosity to study very interesting new things. The moment they start to grow further in their careers in psychology, this eagerness starts to diminish. So if they use it early, they will be able to solve serious problems. That is, when I was teaching in the United States, I always told my undergraduates, you are lucky. Nobody takes you seriously. Therefore, you can study very interesting things. And they first didn't understand, but once they started to do these interesting things, they actually started to understand that they are in a privileged position, although not much knowing, but nevertheless privileged position to try.
Right.
Later on, they would know much more. But this enthusiasm of the young age and interest disappears.
Right. No, I absolutely correct. And I think it would be very suitable for young people who are being shaped by the discipline, by why they choose to adopt a cultural psychological way of thinking critically about all of the assumptions we take for granted in psychology as a science, and also in our environment, I think in everyday life, just to question, perhaps not to demolish or challenge, but to understand, I think. And you mentioned also practical applications. Now, we all know that psychology is a science, and for me at least, that often is good at everything, but perhaps in every field it will have another discipline that can come in and be even a bit more specialized. You have educational psychology, you have pedagogy, you have organizational psychology, you have management studies, and so on. Cultural psychologists, because in Denmark there is a master's program, there is a doctoral school, where do they usually go, and what kind of change do they create in the world? What do you think?
Well, what each of us creates their own change in the world, some very small, some very big. What cultural psychology can do is actually, first of all, be very aware of what the psychologist tries to do in one's environment. That's a very first criterion.
Right.
Because many conditions in the environment are not necessarily helpful for changing it. And secondly, of course, as cultural psychologists can understand the meaning systems of the what is happening now in the environment and what the psychologist wants to bring in.
Mm.
And in the contrast between those two would be the guarantee that the psychologist either succeeds or not.
Right. So developing a much more mindfulness and awareness of what psychology does as a discipline and what's been kind of the project of psychology, and then hopefully creating spaces of more openness, right, around the mainstream, which is always kind of fixed. And I like very much this idea of the openness of the field. Mm-hmm, so I mm-hmm. think this is an invitation for more people to join in. And this at Webster, you're giving one talk on introducing this field and the methods. And I'm hoping you're going to come back and add to this introduction. Hopefully, we will establish some kind of visit, because I think, as you mentioned, communication is the core, the beating heart of this community.
Yeah, I hope so too. I would be very open to developing this kind of joint work, and especially with the notion of involving students in it. That would be very productive.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I've been in dialogue with Professor Jan Walsiner from Aalborg University. If you're interested to listen to more of our podcasts, do look for them at webster.podcast.ch. This has been a talk organized by the Department of Psychology, and we also have many other podcasts on art and artists, on creativity, media, business, and so on. Thank you, Jan, once more.
You're welcome.